No doubt we'd rather look away from the desolation in America's urban schools. But really, it's time to pay attention. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
A national monument to Martin Luther King Jr. has been in place since 2011. That large chunk of marble is solidly planted, but what about what he gave his life for? One would like to think we've come a long way since his well-known I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial back in 1963, the year after that speech. Our guest today, Jonathan Kozol, became a teacher in a Boston public elementary school from which he was fired for including a poem by Langston Hughes in his lessons. That school in the Dorchester section of Boston is now the Martin Luther King School. Kozol went on to become an internationally known educator and author, and he has a new book titled An End to Inequality. So here we are, 60 years later, and we have a statue of Dr. King in Washington, schools named after him, but what about the core issue of inequality? Throughout our culture, systemic racism remains a stubborn obstacle to progress. But what about America's schools? As a society, knowing the huge importance and traditional challenges which have so long existed, most notably in our urban schools, surely we've come a long way toward realizing the dream. Or have we? That great stone monument is there for all to visit. Maybe there are political leaders who think that's enough. Jonathan Kozol doesn't think so. I don't think so, too. I hope you don't either, dear listener. He's been on a long mission for an end to inequality, and the work is nowhere near completion. Growing up in the optimistic, hopeful, energetic 60s, I would not have imagined our guest's article in Nation in the mid-2020s could still bear the title, The Desolation of America's Urban Schools. Now, if you care about education in America, you've probably heard of Jonathan Kozol, but in case you haven't, his 1967 book, Death at an Early Age, is based on his first year as a teacher in the aforementioned public school. The book sold more than 2 million copies in the U.S. and Europe. Jonathan Kozol has spent more than 50 years visiting with children and working with their teachers in many deeply troubled and unequal public schools. His new book, An End to Inequality, points us to a future in which children learn together across lines of class and race in schools where every child is accorded a full and equal share of the riches in this wealthiest of nations. Among other books by Kozol are Rachel and Her Children, Homeless Families in America, his 1995 book Amazing Grace, The Lives of Children and the Conscience of a Nation. He described his visits to the South Bronx, the poorest congressional district in the U.S. He published Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope in 2000, and in 2005, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. In his new book, Kozol documents the continuing and often worsening segregation in public schools in the U.S. and the increasing influence of the neoconservative right-wing ideology on the way children, particularly children of color and poor children of urban areas, are educated. Jonathan Kozol, thank you so much for being with us and for putting up with that long introduction.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bert. I might say right off the bat, the Martin Luther King School is actually not in the same building as the school in which I taught when I wrote in early age. That building has been demolished, but there is a Martin Luther King Elementary School in almost the same neighborhood, I describe it in some detail because the school is in terrible condition. It was renamed. Dr. King spoke on the front steps of the school in early 1960s, and he spoke to a rally of parents and ministers. Who were fighting against segregation. After he died in 1968, the school was renamed for him. But of all, of all ironies, It's now a 98%, 99% Black and Latino school. And it's in ugly physical condition. And ironically, on the website of the school, it says the Martin Luther King School is a fulfillment of the dream of Dr. King.
What's the irony in that?
Well, you know, that's happening all over the country, using the name but not the reality. Any case, the book, the subtitle of the book is Breaking Down the Walls of Apartheid Education in America, and it's the strongest book I've written, because it's a head-on attack on seemingly eternal segregation or resegregation of our schools, and at the same time, the punitive, autocratic agenda that's been put in place in these schools that specifically targets Black and Latino children. The idea is that these kids are uniquely different. They're perceived as if they were a different species of humanity from the rest of our, from the children, the mainstream of America. And there's a sense that they can't learn the normal ways that other children learn, that they can only learn with a sort of fear above their heads. That's what, in the first chapter of my book, I title it 2 Degrees of Separation, because it's not just physical apartheid, but it's also what I would call intellectual apartheid. It's a whole different tone of education. And add to this the fact that many of these schools are in terrible disrepair. The schools that serve Black and Latino children tend to be the older schools in America. Some of them, you know, 70, 80 years old. And you go into them, and right away, if you know what a good school in the suburbs is like, right away, you can feel the difference. It's a different environment. I think physical disrepair matters a lot. I think that beautiful surroundings tell children that we value them. I think that ugly and degrading environments sour their mentalities. In addition to that, many of these schools are dangerous, because these older buildings are still full of crumbling lead paint, flakes from the walls, and sometimes it's in the water also. And this is something that is really unforgivable, because we've known for decades that lead paint poison has irreversible effect on especially on very young children. I call it a kind of cognitive genocide, because it affects their ability to learn. And as I say, it's almost irreversible. And we've known it for a long, long time, but still, we don't condemn the politicians who allow this to go on. Instead, we blame the children for not performing up to the standards that have been set by the national testing mania. So when I was a young teacher, I had a friend named Bill Ryan, who wrote a book called Blaming the Victim. Mm-hmm. And we're still blaming the victim even today. And it happens in gruesome ways. The children are shamed for minor misbehaviors. A little girl is whispering to her friend, mm-hmm. is told, Shaniqua, you're in red zone. And who knows what red zone is, but it's obviously some kind of place you don't want to be. In addition to that, I walked into a classically segregated school in Dorchester in Boston. Mm-hmm. I saw that there was like a closet in the hallway. It once been a storage closet, but it was empty now. And one of the teachers said, oh, that's the lockdown room. They also called it the calm down room. That's where they put a child, typically a little boy who was, who was slowing down the pace of instruction in the classroom because he was maybe laughing or smiling. And I won't go on and on, but another form of really unspeakable brutality is the frequency of arresting young children in school, in their schools. Mm. Kids as young as 6 or 8 in one story I tell in the book, there's a little girl, I think she was 6, in Orlando, Florida, who she'd had, what do you call it when a child has a, she had a tantrum, that's the word. Uh-huh. The school said she had a tantrum in her classroom. So she was brought into the principal's office. And, instead of simply giving her some wise counseling.
Right.
Because schools like these typically can't afford to hire counselors. They call in the police, and he puts zip ties on the little girl.
Oh God!
Literally drags her out of the school, puts her in the back of his police car, and takes her off to a detention center. Talk about the school to prison pipeline.
Yes.
This is the school as a prelude to the prison. It's like the juvenile justice system in the schools themselves. And the whole idea, the whole point is to get these kids to be absolutely obedient, mm-hmm. not to allow their curiosities to distract. Right. From the script that the teacher's typically forced to use. Wow. I call it coercive uniformity.
Right.
Because it's not creating the kinds of citizens who can grow up and ask discerning questions of their political leaders. Mm. It's creating obedient little people who are not being educated for empowerment in American society. Instead, they're being trained for the lower levels of the workplace,
for
which it's assumed that will be their place of employment someday. So I think it's much worse than mere segregation. It's a kind of contempt for the most vulnerable, and often among the most gifted children in America.
Yes.
But we'll never know their gifts because they're being suppressed when they're still barely out of diapers.
Absolutely amazing that it's going on in this day and so far into the 21st century. I can only imagine what the school administration, how they react when they see Jonathan Kozol walking into their school. They know what's going to go on. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today, I'm very honored to have Jonathan Kozol, who is America's perhaps most eloquent and outspoken advocate for equality and racial justice in our public schools. And he's got a brand new book out called An End to Inequality. Now, I was really lucky, and as I get older, I very much value how lucky I was to go to a school in a privileged community. And I graduated that same spring that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. That moment in our history was full of a vibrant optimism for a better, more humane, more equal future. Somehow, I truly figured that the 21st century would highly value public education as a national priority, that would be part of our nation's security, real national security. Apparently, I was a little naive. When you go into these schools in the low-income areas, how does the administration react when they see you there? I guess they...
Well, typically, I mean, the thing is, I've known some of these principals for a long, long time, and I personally get to like them. And a number of these are sort of veteran Black educators, but whether they're Black or white or Latino, they're very warm and friendly to me. And typically,
well, that's good.
After I visited their school during the day, they'll ask me if I'm staying over, would I like to have dinner with them?
Nice.
So it puts me in a very difficult position because despite the fact I like them personally, many of these principals have accepted the racial status quo and will say things to me like, I'm not sure that we need to worry about segregation because now we know what works for these children.
Yeah.
And typically they'll refer to the latest reform that has come along. And I made a list in my book of like 30 cycles of reform we've been through where the officials say, this new reform is going to change everything. It's going to close the gap between the races, even while they're physically apart. And, you know, the phrase is, they'll usually cite some recent academic study and they'll say, so now at last we know it works. And it's like, you know, for the past 2,000 years, nobody knew how to educate children, but now suddenly we do.
Yeah.
What happens is they buy into each passing reform, and if I say to them, but the kids are still sequestered from the mainstream of America. Some of them will even go to the point of saying, I don't see any problem with that. We had wonderful segregated schools in the South, you know, 80 years ago, and we did perfectly well. I quoted that once to John Lewis.
Oh, wow.
Congressman John Lewis.
Sure, great man.
And he just said, don't listen to that. He said, just don't listen to that. They've grown weary of the struggle. But you cannot give up on the dream that brought us here. See? Wonderful man.
Yeah, he knew about how important it was to not let the weariness of the struggle wear you down. We can't surrender. We just can't surrender. And Jonathan, we've had a lot of presidents since your stint at your stint in the Boston schools. President Biden in particular has done a lot for infrastructure, rebuilding our economy, creating new jobs, addressing concerns of working people. What about public education? When was the last time Congress debated school infrastructure spending? And it is about money. Money is a huge factor, I'm sure. I can't imagine the reasoning behind putting off desperately needed repairs year after year. What do you think? Why is it not a priority?
Well, as you know, none of those infrastructure bills, the ones that passed and the ones that didn't pass, none of them assign more money to the public schools.
Right.
There's a climate among a lot of our politicos, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, there's a kind of climate of as if they've given up on the public sector. And they talk a lot about bringing in private business partners.
Right.
And the thing is, they almost never speak of segregation. I'm particularly disheartened because, President Biden, I have this dilemma. A lot of people I bitterly disagree with are fond of me. And when he was in the Senate, he once invited me to his home in Wilmington, Delaware, to give a talk in his backyard to a group of his neighbors on the subject of adult illiteracy, because his wife was interested in that subject. But the fact is, he's a personally sweet and likable man. I remember after the talk, we were sitting in his kitchen having milk and cookies before I went back to the airport. And at the same time, he almost more than any other member of the U.S. Senate for many, many years, was elementally important in placing a stigma on the idea of busing for the sake of integration. He's never disowned his opposition to school busing. He says that he's perfectly in favor of school integration. He's simply opposed to the one and only way by which to make it possible. The last words are mine, of course, not his. But, so on the one hand, I suppose he could be pushed a little bit, but any efforts that he makes are very timid and ineffectual. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we have a roaring racist demagogue in Donald Trump.
Yes.
And on the other hand, we have a personally likable, wimpy semi-liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish he could speak with the voice of FDR.
Right.
I wish he could do it, but he can't. We're in a strange age where, if I can cite the poet William Butler Yeats,
sure,
where the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Yeah, how we got here, I don't know. How we get out of it, I don't know either. And
well, there are some. I mean, there's one major note of optimism in my book.
Please.
And it's the fact that in Boston, after, you know, I was fired from the Boston schools. You mentioned that
mm-hmm.
before,
mm-hmm.
over Langston Hughes.
Right.
And the parents were absolutely outraged. And the black parents, they're outraged, and they staged a sit-in at the school. And then they asked me to join with them in running a freedom school in the neighborhood, which we did together. And those parents became the core group fighting for desegregation of the Boston schools. And when it became obvious that this was impossible, that it wasn't going to happen, they wisely looked out to the suburbs. And I was part of this movement. Several of the suburbs, including Newton, mm-hmm. Joined with the parents. The suburbs that had, you know, they had a lot of progressive people living there, like Newton, people like Howard Zinn, for example,
mm-hmm.
and lots of well-educated.
Yes, people who value really, education, yeah.
Who really did have a social conscience, too.
Yes, yes.
So the ultimately 33 suburbs joined the program. It's called METCO.
Oh, yeah.
And I taught in it for 2 years in the Newton schools, by the way,
uh-huh.
In West Newton Square. And the thing is, at a gloomy time in America, it's an understatement, you know, at an awful mm-hmm. moment in our history,
yeah.
METCO is a real exception. And it's a great model of what is possible when people are willing to act on their beliefs. The program has 3,000 kids in it who ride the bus every day. There's no fear of losing their racial identity because the program places great emphasis on multiracial curricula and it's a sensitively cultivated program. The statistics are amazing. The kids who ride the bus, black and Latino kids who ride the bus to these suburbs, have a 4-year graduation rate from high school of something like 95%.
Wow.
And virtually all of them go on to 4-year colleges and then into the professions. A number become teachers. And, you know, if we were looking for optimism in America,
mm-hmm.
that would be an ideal place to look, because mm-hmm. it's not just that that the kids who ride the bus are academically so successful, but they also are able to, without losing a bit of their racial pride
mm-hmm.
and their identity, they're also able to make deep friendships across the lines of class and race, and friendships that endure for their entire lives. I'm thinking of one young man whom I knew when he was a child, name is John Walker, who rode the bus to another Boston suburb, Brookline,
mm-hmm.
with which you're familiar.
Yeah.
And after graduation, he went to college. And after college, he came back to Brookline. They hired him to be an elementary school teacher, where he taught for 30 years. And because he was a gifted musician, he was a very good blues and folk guitarist, he wedded the Mississippi blues, the Delta blues, that ultimately became the Chicago blues. He wedded that to the history of black migration, and it was a marvelous example of combining the arts with history.
Oh, yes.
And in a way that was fascinating to all the children. I sat in his classroom once, maybe about 7 years ago, and he was playing. He was playing Huddy Ledbetter.
Uh huh. Also known as Lead Belly.
Yeah, I was just about to say, generally known as Lead Belly, and the kids, they were the kids holding hands with each other in a circle around him, Asian, white, black, Latino, and singing along with him when they could pick up the words. I remember thinking, this is what America could be.
Yes. That's the frustrating thing, what America could be, the aspirations that Abraham Lincoln had after the Civil War. It really started then. And to have a situation where kids who are naturally curious and excited, and to have a situation where, you know, it's autocratic, and just totally controlling, and to shut down their curiosity. What an incredible waste. What an incredible...
And the worst, well, not the worst, but right along with this is the fact that really good teachers are crushed by needing to conform to this, this rote and drill, test-driven agenda. They're told, don't smile so much. Be so relaxed. Don't let the children's curiosity lead you off track from the goal that's stated for that day.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and what happens is teachers who have really charming personalities, the kinds of teachers you would remember years later, say, oh, I had this wonderful teacher in the fifth grade.
Sure.
These kinds of teachers their personality is being suppressed.
Right.
So I tell the story, I won't ramble on too long, but I tell the story in the book of a teacher in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which, as you recall, is a very poor industrial town. Almost entirely Puerto Rican and Dominican children. And the teacher's classroom was invaded by three teacher retrainers, as they're called, three coaches from a private sector firm with which the public sector, with which the public schools had contracted. Private sector alleged experts who sat in the back row in her classroom, made her wear an earpiece so they could talk to her while she was teaching, and they told her, trying to remember the exact words, this is a paraphrase. They told her that she was smiling too much. You look too happy and too enthusiastic. You're giving too much praise. You're not standing stiff and straight. We want you to stand in mountain pose. That was the term. One of the boys in the class noticed the earpiece and said, teacher, what's that thing in your ear? And the coaches told her, don't answer him. And he asked it again. He asked her again. He wouldn't give up. The coaches said, give him a detention.
Oh, my goodness.
but it's sort of like a sad story with a happy ending. The little boy got up at that point. I love feisty kids.
Yeah.
What I would call you know, wisely irreverent, but not maliciously, but cleverly malevolent, cleverly irreverent. Uh-huh. And he stood up and he said, "Don't listen to them, teacher. Listen to me. I'm a person. You're a person too. Be you." Well, I love kids who can, I don't know where the, you know, if you give kids enough respect, they can
respect.
College things that wise adults wouldn't think of saying.
Right.
I love it.
Right.
So be you. But the trouble is, teachers nowadays are being scapegoated for everything.
And, yes.
It's not an easy time to be a teacher. So I wanted to say that very just because in my, what I'm condemning in my book is the system. I'm not condemning.
Right.
I'm not condemning the that good, hardworking third grade teacher who.
Oh, absolutely. The teachers are, I mean, I know a lot of teachers, and they're all there. They're not there for the money. They're not there to get rich. And they're there to, for the incredible reward of firing up kids' curiosity and actually educating them. If you just
I'm glad you used that word, firing up, because, you know, the I'm sure you've heard the, that old expression, which actually goes back to, I think goes back to Roman, one of the Roman Greek classics. I bet you can anticipate what I'm going to say.
No, I don't.
The education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire.
Ah, and I hadn't heard that. Thank you. That's great. I can absolutely see what that is.
But nothing could be more out of fashion at this moment in America, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. If you just tuned in, dear listener, our guest today, I'm very honored to have Jonathan Kozol, who is America's perhaps most eloquent and outspoken advocate for equality and racial justice in our public schools. We're talking about his new book, out of many books, An End to Inequality. And the mood of the country, as you mentioned that a little bit, it's really unique. I mean, you talk about punitive autocratic. That makes me think of a certain rather large orange guy who was president a few years ago. Punitive and autocratic. And students, families, educators, and school board members across the whole country are facing unprecedented attacks from far-right extremists, like groups like Moms for Liberty. I don't know if you've heard of them. They want to dismantle our public schools. They seek to ban a lot of books. What's their motivation? Is there actually an anti-education agenda at the national level? Is it intentional or just incompetence?
I don't think it's anti-education. I think it's anti-public sector.
Well, yeah.
I think it's a war on the public school system,
right,
on the part of a what I call a corporate invasion.
Mm-hmm.
The Moms for Liberty, I'm told, are underwritten by corporate groups.
Okay.
I may be wrong, but one obvious aspect of the war on the public system is what I call the myth of scarcity.
Right.
The pretense, you know, parents can say, you know, when are you going to rebuild this?
Uh-huh, right.
This disgusting old building.
Right.
Restore our school library? Because libraries are disappearing from the public schools.
Oh, wow.
And typically the politicians say, you know, we would like to do all that,
right,
but our hands are tied because of funding shortages.
Yeah, sure.
And I call it the myth of scarcity in one of the richest nations in the world. Sometimes it's legitimate if there's a economic crisis. And there really is a shortage of revenue. But what happens is, during the crisis period, this happened in New York in the 1970s, during the crisis period, they will cut back everything. It's got an emergency plan.
Yeah,
but austerity. But then after the crisis is passed, they don't restore what they don't restore those cutbacks.
Absolutely right.
So it goes on and on and on. I always say that the myth of scarcity, when it comes to the funding of public schools, is a colossal lie, and we need to criticize and openly combat any political leader who tries to perpetrate this deception. It's a lie. It's lying to children. The same lie is used in regard to programs like Head Start, which around the time when you were in high school, which was when I had just been fired in Boston
right.
and began to teach in Newton in Metco, around that time, you know, there was this genuine, honorable effort to restore authentic justice in America. I shouldn't say restore because
right.
we had never had it, but to get rid of Jim Crow education forever. And public education, as I remember at least, was highly valued. There was no question that a democratic nation needs a well-financed, flourishing public system.
Can't have democracy without it. And I think a lot of the autocratic, plutocratic wannabes know that you can't have democracy without public education, and they like it that way. And I've noticed,
and that's the period I was going to say when I lost track of myself before. That was the period, just when you were in high school, when Head Start was created and was viewed as, you know, an absolute essential way of leveling the playing field for children before they entered public school. And I was very close to the Head Start movement. In fact, I helped to start one of the first Head Start programs in Boston, in the old South End of Boston. But after all these years, at least a million kids are still unable to enjoy this opportunity. And President, a lot of candidates for office always say, you know, if I'm elected, I'm going to insist on universal pre-K. And every one of those promises has been broken. So I think this is just one part of what I would call the myth of scarcity, as if we don't have enough money to do this, when virtually every other modern Western nation does have something
absolutely
very similar to universal pre-K. And this is like telling a lie, not just to the public, but telling a lie to three-year-olds. Like, we don't have enough money to give you what folks on Park Avenue are buying for their children.
Kids see through that, yeah.
They do.
Of course they do.
I ended my piece in the Nation with the words of a Russian poet whose name is very hard to pronounce. Yevgeny Yevtushenko.
Okay.
I hope I'm saying that right. Yevgeny Yevtushenko, who wrote a poem in which he said, "Telling lies to the young is wrong." He said, "The young know what you mean." And he ended saying essentially that these lies will come back to haunt you.
Now,
as it does. And I believe, anyway, I don't like telling lies to children.
No, you know, I think you always get caught in a lie. I don't know, maybe not always. But, you know, it does, let's face it, to refurbish these schools, to replace them, you know, it's a lot of money. And municipalities can't do it by themselves. There's a relatively poor community around here that had a really falling apart high school, but it's a poor town. Municipalities can't do it alone. That would mean raising taxes in low-income areas.
That's right.
And you know, it would cost a lot of money to replace and update archaic lead and copper plumbing systems and to rebuild these things. Where should the money come from, Jonathan?
I was about to say, well, the first big obstacle is the fact that we're still stuck with this archaic school finance system.
Right.
That makes absolutely no sense in the modern democracy. It's basically a colonial funding system, which each area, the primary funding for the public schools depends on local property wealth.
Yes, that's crazy.
So if you live in a neighborhood where homes are worth $3 million, $4 million, you're going to have a very large revenue stream for your schools.
Right.
And if you don't, you're out of luck. The one answer, I believe, well, two. First of all, I hope someday we can pass a constitutional amendment that makes education a federal responsibility.
Amen.
Which it is not today.
Yes.
According to notorious 1973 Supreme Court decision called Rodriguez versus San Antonio, in which the court, Supreme Court ruled that there is no national obligation to provide children with an equal education.
Whoa.
But, and that's never been reversed.
Wow.
But because the other possibility, and this will make me sound very naive and romantic, would be if we did have an eloquent and courageous president of the character level of FDR.
Yes.
I hark back to him just because I can still remember the day he died. Oh. I was an infant, but I remember my mother standing in the window crying.
Right.
If we had a president with that kind of imaginative eloquence, perhaps you need to have the guts to propose a $500 billion federal grant program to entice and compensate suburban districts all around the country to essentially join in a single metropolitan schooling district in which all children, black, white children, can cross the lines of class and race. Either direction. Metco, which I love, is only a one-way program because nobody who lives in Newton or Wellesley or Concord or other wealthy suburbs are going to send their kids to the Boston schools.
Right.
I don't blame them.
Right.
But the ultimate dream would be to a two-way program where, in addition to, some kids would ride the bus out of the city to some of these beautiful districts, other kids from those districts would be coming into the city to go to spectacular magnet schools. We speak of magnet schools, mm-hmm. but very few of them. There are very few, and most of the ones I know are not terribly magnetic. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about spectacular schools. Like in an area like Boston, it wouldn't be hard to imagine if we had the kind of really? The billions of dollars we would need. It's not hard to imagine spectacular schools in the city or sort of on the border between the city and the suburbs that were affiliated with the great medical centers of Boston. Boston is famous worldwide for its medical research and its hospitals and medical schools. It's also famous for its music and art. There's wonderful museums in Boston, including Black History Museums. There's so much that could entice kids to go both directions.
Well, you think about...
I won't live to see it, obviously. I'm 87.
Well, I hope I do. I'm only 73. But I don't know. I'll tell you.
Right. Neither of us are likely to live to see it.
Unfortunately.
I hope this book will help to spur the next generation, the younger generation.
I hope so.
To rise up in militant resistance.
Yes.
To a racist status quo and essentially to carry on the torch that Dr. King and so many others lighted those years ago.
Lighting that fire, we need to do that. And you talk about the myth of scarcity. You know, an F-35 military jet costs over $100 million each. Does that make us safer? Does that really increase national security? I don't think so. And I think what you're talking about, I have the feeling that if an FDR-type president came along and really invested, you'd create a lot of jobs, you'd make a lot of neighborhoods and communities much more solid. People would be happy, but these politicians, where's their backbone? I don't know. I mean, Mayor Eric Adams of New York recently abandoned plans to make the city's 3-to-K program universal. He cut the city's preschool budget by $170 million. And it's amazing how our national leaders just don't deal with this. They need to hear it from the bottom. And you've no doubt heard the story of when FDR was meeting with A. Philip Randolph of the Pullman Porters Union, when FDR told him, I want to end segregation. I want to, you know, treat you guys fairly. Now go out and make me do it. That's what we need to do. We need to do
it. Yes. I never knew that quote.
Oh, that's a great quote.
That's wonderful. I mean, I won't go off on the mayor of New York City. Mm. That's another very sad story.
Yes.
But I do think, I don't know. I mean, we've been through the same thing in Boston, not exactly the same, but similar. And the one thing that sort of maddens me repeatedly is that, some mayors, unlike the mayor of New York, mm-hmm. some mayors will actually say, you know, that I want to do this, and I'm going to do it, whatever it may be, mm-hmm. whatever we're demanding. But then you wait a few years, and they appoint a commission.
A commission, right.
To look into it, just to discuss it.
Pass the buck.
And then the commission takes a few years, and then they come out with a report which recommends construction of so many schools during the next 20 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes on forever. And by the time, by the time we reach the point of nirvana, that they're promising, none of the kids who are entering school today will still be students. I always say, in a sense, once we steal the years of childhood from a child, it's like an irreversible theft, because we can never give them back. They never get to live those years a second time. This is it. They have it once, and then it's gone forever. I just wish those of us who share our beliefs could find enough powerful allies,
yeah,
so that we could actually, so we could disrupt the laissez-faire climate no need to do anything drastic. Let's just polish the apple of apartheid a little bit. I don't know what it would take to find allies who are militant enough.
And the thing is, if this went on, if what you're talking about, sorry to interrupt, but if what you're talking about were to happen, you know, the Democrats wouldn't have a problem with our black supporters, you know, being a little bit not so sure. And young people, those two demographics, why they, it's amazing how they don't do that. There's all kinds of possibilities. People are good. They want to do the right thing. But I don't know, politicians just see national security in a way I think is a little bit nuts, quite frankly. Well, it's been an honor, a real honor, to speak with you, Jonathan Kozol, as I say, America's most eloquent and outspoken advocate for equality and racial justice in our public schools. His new book is titled An End to Inequality, Working Together, Raising Our Voices, Making Good Trouble, as Congressman Lewis used to say. Perhaps we can do it. It takes a lot of persistence, that's for sure. A lot of time and a lot of persistence. Thank you so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
Thank you, Bert. So be true to your school.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Please ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.